This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, and to find out how you can volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recorded by Ian Bartholomew. The History of England from the Accession of James II. Thomas Babington Macaulay. Book 1, Chapter 4, Part 4. Soon after the Restoration, in the gay and dissolute times which had been celebrated by the lively pen of Hamilton, James, young and ardent in the pursuit of pleasure, had been attracted to Arabella Churchill, one of the maids of honour who waited on his first wife. The young lady was plain, but the taste of James was not nice, and she became his avowed mistress. She was the daughter of a poor Cavalier knight who haunted Whitehall, and made himself ridiculous by publishing a dour and affected folio, long forgotten, in praise of monarchy and monarchs. The necessities of the Churchills were pressing, their loyalty was ardent, and their only feeling about Arabella's seduction seems to have been joyful surprise that so homely a girl should have attained to such high preferment. Her interest was indeed of great use to her relations, but none of them were so fortunate as her eldest brother John, a fine youth who carried a pair of colours in for cards. He rose fast in the court and in the army, and was early distinguished as a man of fashion and of pleasure. His stature was commanding, his face handsome, his address singularly winning, yet of such dignity that the most impertinent fops never ventured to take any liberty with him. His temper, even in the most vexatious and irritating circumstances, always under perfect command. His education had been so much neglected that he could not spell the most common words of his own language, but his acute and vigorous understanding amply supplied the place of book learning. He was not talkative, but when he was forced to speak in public, his natural eloquence moved the envy of practiced rhetoricians. His courage was singularly cool and imperturbable. During many years of anxiety and peril, he never, in any emergency, lost even for a moment the perfect use of his admirable judgment. In his 23rd year, he was sent with his regiment to join the French forces, then engaged in operations against Holland. His serene intrepidity distinguished him among thousands of brave soldiers. His professional skill commanded the respect of veteran officers. He was publicly thanked at the head of the army, and received many marks of esteem and confidence from Turenne, who was then at the height of military glory. Unhappily, the splendid qualities of John Churchill were mingled with alloy of the most sordid kind. Some propensities, which in youth are singularly ungraceful, began very early to show themselves in him. He was thrifty in his very vices, and levied ample contributions on ladies enriched by the spoils of one occasion, he was caught with her by the king and was forced to leap out of the window. She rewarded this hazardous feat of gallantry with a present of £5,000. With this sum, the prudent young hero instantly bought an annuity of £500 a year, well secured on landed property. Already his private drawer contained a hoard of gold pieces, which, 50 years later, when he was a duke, a prince of the empire, and the richest subject in Europe, remained untouched. After the close of the war, he was attached to the household of the Duke of York, accompanied his patron to the Low Countries and to Edinburgh, and was rewarded for his services with the Scotch peerage and with the command of the only regiment of dragoons which was then on the English establishment. His wife had a post in the family of James's younger daughter, the Princess of Denmark. Lord Churchill was now sent as ambassador extraordinary to Versailles. He had it in charge to express the warm gratitude of the English government for the money which had been so generously bestowed. It had been originally intended that he should at the same time ask Louis for a much larger sum. But on full consideration, it was apprehended that such indelicate greediness might disgust the benefactor whose spontaneous liberality had been so signally displayed. Churchill was therefore directed to confine himself to thanks for what was past, and to say nothing about the future. But James and his ministers, even while protesting that they did not mean to be importunate, contrived to hint, very intelligibly, what they wished and expected. In the French ambassador, they had a dexterous, a zealous, and perhaps not a disinterested intercessor. Louis made some difficulties, probably with the design of enhancing the value of his gifts. In a very few weeks, however, Barillon received from Versailles 1,500,000 livres more. This sum, equivalent to about £112,000 sterling, he was instructed to dole out cautiously. He was authorized to furnish the English government with £30,000 for the purpose of corrupting members of the new House of Commons. The rest he was directed to keep in reserve as an extraordinary emergency, such as a dissolution or an insurrection. The turpitude of these transactions was universally acknowledged, but their real nature seems to be often misunderstood. Though the foreign policy of the last two kings of the House of Stuart has never, since the correspondence of Barillon was exposed to the public eye, found an apologist among us, there is still a party which labours to excuse the domestic policy. Yet it is certain that between their domestic policy and their foreign policy, there was a necessary and indissoluble connection. If they had upheld, during a single year, the honour of the country abroad, they would have been compelled to change the whole system of their administration at home. To praised them for refusing to govern in conformity with the sense of Parliament, and yet to blame them for submitting to the direction of Louis is inconsistent, for they had only one choice, to be dependent on Louis or to be dependent on Parliament. James, to do him justice, would gladly have found a third way, but there was none. He became the slave of France, but it would be incorrect to represent him as a contented slave. He had spirit enough to be at times angry with himself for submitting to such thraldom, and impatient to break loose from it. And this disposition was studiously encouraged by the agents of many foreign powers. His accession had excited hopes and fears in every continental court, and the commencement of his administration was watched by strangers with interest scarcely less deep than that which was felt by his own subjects. One government alone wished that the troubles which had, during three generations, distracted England might be eternal. All other governments, whether republican or monarchical, whether Protestant or Roman Catholic, wished to see those troubles happily terminated. The nature of the long contest between the Stuarts and their parliaments was indeed very imperfectly apprehended by foreign statesmen. But no statesman could fail to perceive the effect which that contest had produced on the balance of power in Europe. In ordinary circumstances, the sympathies of the courts of Vienna and Madrid would doubtless have been with the prince struggling against subjects, and especially with the Roman Catholic prince struggling against heretical subjects. But all such sympathies were now overpowered by a stronger feeling, the fear and hatred inspired by the greatness, the injustice, and the arrogance of the French king were at the height. His neighbors might well doubt whether it were more dangerous to be at war or at peace with him. For in peace he continued to plunder and to outrage them, and they had tried the chances of war against him in vain. In this perplexity, they looked with intense anxiety towards England. Would she act on the principle of the Triple Alliance, or on the principles of the Treaty of Dover? On that issue depended the fate of all her neighbors. With her help, Louis might be withstood, but no help could be expected from her till she was at unity with herself. Before the strife between the throne and the Parliament began, she had been a power of the first rank. On the day on which that strife terminated, she became a power of the first rank again. But while the dispute remained undecided, she was condemned to inaction and to vassalage. She had been great under the Plantagenets and Tudors. She was again great under the princes who reigned after the Revolution. And under the kings of the House of Stuart, she was a blank in the map of Europe. She had lost one class of energies and had not yet acquired another. That species of force, is a force which in the 18th century humbled France and Spain once more, had not yet been called into action. The government was no longer a limited monarchy after the fashion of the Middle Ages. It had not yet become a limited monarchy after the modern fashion. With the vices of two different systems, it had the strength of neither. The elements of our polity, instead of combining in harmony, counteracted and neutralized each other. All was transition, conflict, and disorder. The chief business of the sovereign was to infringe the privileges of the legislature. The chief business of the legislature was to encroach on the prerogatives of the sovereign. The king readily accepted foreign aid, which relieved him from the misery of being dependent on a mutinous parliament. The Parliament refused the king the means of supporting the national honor abroad from an apprehension too well founded that these means might be employed in order to establish despotism at home. The effect of these jealousies was that our country, with all her vast resources, was of as little weight in Christendom as the Duchy of Savoy or the Duchy of Lorraine, and certainly of far less weight than the small province of Holland. France was deeply interested in prolonging this state of things. All other powers were deeply interested in bringing it to a close. The general wish of Europe was that James would govern in conformity with law and with public opinion. From the Escurial itself came letters expressing an earnest hope that the new King of England would be on good terms with his parliament and his people. From the Vatican itself came cautions against immoderate zeal for the Roman Catholic faith. Benedict Odescalchi, who filled the papal chair under the name of Innocent XI, felt in his character of temporal sovereign all the apprehensions with which other princes watched the progress of the French power. He had also grounds of uneasiness which were peculiar to himself. It was a happy circumstance for the Protestant religion that, at the moment when the Roman Catholic King of England mounted the throne, the Roman Catholic Church was torn by dissension and threatened with a new schism. A quarrel similar to that which had raged in the 11th century between the emperors and the supreme pontiffs had arisen between Louis and Innocent. Louis, zealous even to bigotry for the doctrines of the Church of Rome, but tenacious of his regal authority, accused the Pope of encroaching on the secular rights of the French crown, and was in turn accused by the Pope of encroaching on the spiritual power of the keys. The king, haughty as he was, encountered a spirit even more determined than his own. Innocent was, in all private relations, the meekest and gentlest of men. But when he spoke officially from the chair of St. Peter, he spoke in the tones of Gregory VII and of Sixtus V. The dispute became serious. Agents of the king were excommunicated. Adherents of the pope were banished. The king made the champion. weapons of his authority, bishops. The Pope refused an institution. They took possession of the episcopal palaces and revenues, but they were incompetent to perform the episcopal functions. Before the struggle terminated, there were in France 30 prelates who could not confirm or ordain. Had any prince then living, except Louis, been engaged in such a dispute with the Vatican, he would have had all Protestant governments on his side. But the fear and resentment which the ambition and insolence of the French king had inspired were such that whoever had the courage manfully to oppose him was sure of public sympathy. Even Lutherans and Calvinists, who had always detested the Pope, could not refrain from wishing him success against a tyrant who aimed at universal monarchy. It was thus that, in the present century, many who regarded Pius VII as Antichrist were well pleased to see Antichrist confront the gigantic power of Napoleon. The resentment which Innocent felt towards France disposed him to take a mild and liberal view of the affairs of England. The return of the English people to the fold of which he was the shepherd would undoubtedly have rejoiced his soul, but he was too wise a man to believe that a nation so bold and stubborn could be brought back to the Church of Rome by the violent and unconstitutional exercise of royal authority. It was not difficult to foresee that, if James attempted to promote the interests of his religion by illegal and unpopular means, the attempt would fail. The hatred with which the heretical islanders regarded the true faith would become fiercer and stronger than ever, and an indissoluble association would be created in their minds between Protestantism and civil freedom, between popery and arbitrary power. In the meantime, the king would be an object of aversion and suspicion to his people. England would still be, as she had been under James I, under Charles I, and under Charles II, a power of the third rank, and France would domineer unchecked beyond the Alps and the Rhine. On the other hand, it was probable that James, by acting with prudence and moderation, by strictly observing the laws and by exerting himself to win the confidence of his parliament, might be able to obtain, for the professors of his religion, a large measure of relief. Penal statutes would go first. Statutes imposing civil incapacities would soon follow. In the meantime, the English king and the English nation, united, might head the European coalition and might oppose the insuperable barrier to the cupidity of Louis. Innocent was confirmed in his judgment by the principal Englishmen who resided at his court. Of these, the most illustrious was Philip Howard, sprung from the noblest houses of Britain, grandson on one side of the Earl of Arundel, on the other of the Duke of Lennox. Philip had long been a member of the Sacred College. He was commonly designated as Cardinal of England. In chief counselor of the RDC in matters relating to his country. He had been driven into exile by the outcry of Protestant bigots, and a member of his family, the unfortunate Stafford, had fallen a victim to their rage. But neither the cardinal's own wrongs nor those of his house had so heated his mind as to make him a rash adviser. Every letter, therefore, which went from the Vatican to Whitehall, recommended